All right, thank you. My name is Stephen Owens. I'm a 44-year-old from Heston, Kansas here. The date is August 6, 2022, and I am in the StoryCorps virtual recording booth, and I'm here with Julia, my one small step partner. Or maybe that was supposed to be Jim, my one small step partner, and if so, I apologize.
My name is Jim Unruh, and I'm 56-year-old. And the date is August 6, 2022, and I'm in the StoryCorps virtual recording booth, and I'm here with Stephen Owens, my one-step conversational partner.
Thanks, Jim. Thanks, Stephen. Why did you both want to do this one small step conversation today?
Well, I can tell you from my perspective, when I heard the opportunity to have constructive dialogue with somebody, I always welcome that opportunity. As an elected official, I always enjoy talking with people from a different political spectrum. I think there's so much to be learned between us. And so this was just another opportunity for that to occur.
And the same is true with me, and slightly would be different in the sense of from my theological perspective and faith perspective, it's really important to hear people and to try to find common ground on that. And I think, and also part of Kansas Leadership Center, I've attended that, and it's really important to listen to different people's perspective. I think we have more in common than sometimes is on the surface, so.
Great. Well, we'll get started with bios. So, Stephen, could you go ahead and please read Jim's bio?
Sure. I have been married for 26 years. We have lived in Hutchinson for 20 years. I work as a chaplain and do community-based ministry, which to us means caring and sharing mutually with people in the community. We have an adult special needs son whom we adopted, a 19-year-old birth son studying journalism at Wichita State, a 17-year-old daughter, who will be a senior who has dealt with long COVID for over 18 months, and our 14-year-old granddaughter whom we adopted. I escaped through sports, especially Chiefs and Royals.
Great. And Jim, could you go ahead and please read Stephen's bio?
Sure. I'm a conservative Republican state legislator who is blessed to be able to spend more time then 6 months out of the year in service to the citizens of the state. I am a husband, father, business owner, and mentor. I love to share my failures and my successes with the younger generations to help them understand that anything is possible with hard work and preparation. I believe that we are each the summation of our life experiences. Your life is not for me to judge.
Is there anything in the bios that either of you would like to start with a question on?
Sure, I'd love to. Jim, I'd love to understand your background. What church do you pastor at? Your theological background, just so I can understand that a little more.
Yeah, Stephen. So we're going to have a lot of common threads here a little bit. I just glanced at your Wikipedia page a little bit ago, and so. So I'm from the Mennonite background and pastoring at First Mennonite, well, minister of outreach at First Mennonite here in Hutchinson, a graduate of Bethel College. I would have grown up in Greensburg. And so my father was the hospital administrator. My mom was a nurse. My great grandparents were still alive in Greensburg at the time. And so I knew them fairly well, and so I saw where my grandfather grew up. So I would be a sixth and seventh generation Kansan, and so, deeply committed to our community and our state. So
that's wonderful. What a great story. We're both Bethel grads, which is fantastic. Go Threshers. And maybe to kind of answer that question on my own, just for your perspective, if you don't mind. My wife and I, girlfriend at the time, actually came up here from Oklahoma. We're both originally from Oklahoma. And it was Bethel College that brought us up here.
Okay.
I had an opportunity to play football there. And they offered my wife a football scholarship as well to get me there. So two football scholarships for one person. Wow. Of course, that made me feel good at the time, but early on, it was all about football. But I come to realize at Bethel, it's worth a whole lot more. And my wife and I, we got married after our first year at Bethel and moved to Heston, which is just 7 miles up the road and have been part of the community here for 25 years. So we're first generation Kansans. And from a religious background, Christian as well, I'm a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And so I have a tremendous amount of Mennonite friends here in Heston. I believe there's 4 Mennonite churches, and yeah, have an enormous amount of respect for the work that you guys do. It's amazing that our theological beliefs really aren't that far apart. I've always felt that Mennonites and Latter-day Saints, there's a lot of similarities in a lot of our history and what we have gone through, and similar beliefs on what's going to get us back to heaven. So I look forward to continuing to discuss that a little bit and maybe tie that in with some other pieces.
Yeah. And Stephen, since we're closer than that too, so my grandparents settled in Heston. And so my my brother and my parents are actually in Heston right now. So my parents are in the retirement community right on Ridge Road there.
Absolutely.
And, yeah. And you probably know my brother, or at least my nieces, so Jay and Melissa Unruh. Yep. And so Kelsey played basketball and runs the pool in Heston. So,
yep, absolutely. Small world. I love it.
There we go. So
my dad was in Showalter Villa for about 4 years and passed away about 5 years ago now. Okay. So I have a tremendous admiration for the work that they do. And especially throughout this COVID pandemic, has been remarkable to see the work that James Kaufman and the Blue Stem communities have done to take care of our family. So grateful for that.
Yep.
Tell me a little bit about, so I come from a family of 11 children, mm-hmm. of which 7 were adopted. So when I was 8, we adopted 4 kids. And then when I was a little bit older, my family adopted 3 more. So I thought it was great that you have an adopted son. And so I'd love to hear more about that and what led you to adoption.
Yeah, I think just taking for granted the blessing of my childhood and parents and grandparents and those things. And so when my wife and I met, that was part of our early conversations of wanting to adopt. We were actually in Philadelphia at the time. And so I chased my soon-to-be wife to Philadelphia where she was studying. And so we adopted our son in Philadelphia. He was 13 at the time. He's a special needs individual who actually lives in a group home in Newton.
Okay.
So that was part of the journey. The circumstances were that she was working full time, I was working part time. So we wanted to do a school age child. We wanted to go male because I would be the primary caregiver at the beginning, and so and we were leaning towards the special needs area, and so the timing was fine, and we. The thing we did not want to do was they had this huge thick catalog that we could look through, and we didn't want to do that. We said, you choose the kid for us and we'll love the kid. So we were very blessed. The first one they sent to us was the one that connected to our hearts. And then about a year later, we moved to Kansas. And so that's where our birth children were born, here in Hutchinson. Our son had a child, and so we adopted her. So she's 14, going to be a freshman at Hutch High. So she lives with us now too. So, and she's been with us for the last, the years gets fuzzy, but last 6 or 7 years. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Excellent. Well, I have 3 kids myself, mm-hmm. And I have a, 22-year-old daughter who lives here in Heston. She actually helps. She's a realtor and helps run one of my real estate companies that I have, because I've invested in real estate for a lot of years. So she helps with that. Her husband's a police officer here in town, which is super awesome. Just graduated from the law enforcement training center. I have my middle daughter, Bailey. Oh, by the way, Caitlin's 22. Bailey's 20. Bailey is married to a young man named Gunner, and they live in Cary, Idaho, which is just south of Sun Valley. Beautiful area. And we had our first granddaughter in April.
Congratulations.
Very, very exciting. And our other daughter, our oldest who lives here in town, is due in January. So very excited to be grandparents again. And then I have a 17-year-old senior at home. So pretty similar there.
Okay. So a senior at Heston?
Uh-huh.
Okay, very good. So a swather, very good.
That's it, no swathers.
So what led you to be interested in state legislation?
You know, that's really a great question. I never thought during my Bethel years or early in my professional life that being involved politically was even on my radar, because it wasn't. But what I did realize as time passed and as I begin to, you know, build my companies and get more involved in the politics that affect the ability for businesses to operate in Kansas, I found myself in Topeka on a couple of occasions, either testifying on legislation or trying to meet up with my state representative. And I'll never forget when I met with my state representative and I sat in his office. And while I was able to meet with him, I could tell he was looking right through me. And I could tell that he wasn't engaging with my concern. And it kind of set a bad tone. And so I just kind of sat back and I was like, wow, we could really use some different representation in the area. And this individual, great man, by the way, I'll never speak ill of him, but he was in office for many years. And I think that sometimes when you're in office for a while, it's easy to get kind of complacent. For a couple of years, I considered running against him, but I thought, well, maybe somebody else will run. And it was towards the end of, he had been there 12 years and had ran unopposed the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. And so I took him out to breakfast and I said, you know, just wanted to let you know I'm going to run against you. It's nothing personal. I don't agree with a few of your votes, but I just really think that our community deserves leadership that is engaged, that is representative of who they are, and has the desire to commit to being involved in the public. And so that's what led me to run. I was able to win the Republican primary. Didn't have a Democrat general, and that was in 2018. So about 4 years ago, and I've had the opportunity to serve ever since, and it has been just fascinating to learn. And I could dive into this for 2 hours by itself,
right?
But I won't. But I can tell you that it's fascinating to learn and to understand our state. I get to learn so much about so many different things I had no idea about, the state agencies, with how organizations work, with the needs and the challenges that we have. But then also, I've had the ability to really help steer our state in what I believe is a family-centered approach to politics, because I believe that at my core, I believe that the family unit is really under attack. I believe that Satan's number one goal is to destroy the family unit, because if he can destroy the family unit, he can really get into people's hearts. And so I keep that perspective in mind anytime I make a decision. The perspective of how would God want this decision to be made to better the people and to better the family unit? And that's family is just such an important part of that for me. So that's kind of what led me to it. And I can dive into any aspect of that further if you have another question.
Yeah. So is there any things that you wanted to see happen when you first arrived, and has that shifted?
Good question. So I didn't know what to expect when I first arrived, right? I went in there with a whole bunch of ideas, but you realize early on that your first year, if you're smart, you just kind of sit there and you learn because there's so much to understand about the process. Your second year, a little bit more comfortable, but it wasn't until my third year that I really had a chance to dig in. I have a company that works within the criminal justice system and works with pre and post trial defendants. So I've spent 20 years working with people in that arena. And so I actually sit on the corrections and juvenile justice committee, as well as judiciary and appropriation. So I've been able to take that experience and really utilize that. And actually last year was just appointed the chairman of that the Corrections Juvenile Justice Committee, which opened even more doors, because I like to focus a lot on, you know, substance use and how do we help people through that and provide those doors and mental health and how do we get the people the help that they need, because our jail and our prison system are just jam packed with people for those two reasons. Those are the drivers. And I've always believed the more that I can do in those arenas, the better. And so that's always been my focus since I've gotten in there, is on the corrections and juvenile justice side of things. So, have my opinions changed? Perspectives? Yes, because one of the things that I've realized, talking maybe about, for example, the state budget, it's easy to talk about, I'm going to go up there and I'm going to cut the budget. But it's another thing altogether to actually be able to do it, because government budgets do so much good for so many people, right? Mm-hmm. And without a doubt, any state agency could do more with more. But the question is, where is that cost benefit analysis, right? If I can spend a dollar and I'm affecting 10 people, but down the road I spend that same dollar and I'm affecting 0.5 people, is that a dollar well spent? So it's really helped me open my mind, open my eyes to realize some of the challenges in budgets and the lack of control that the legislature actually has over state agencies. That's an executive level function. So it's not like I can go in and micromanage a state agency. All I really affect is their budget. So mm-hmm. It's been really a remarkable and fascinating experience to be able to learn. It's my favorite thing to do, is to be able to learn. And then finally, I'll talk about this in a little bit, but I really want to talk about the relationships, because relationships in Topeka are so very important. Mm-hmm. And people don't realize how much we work together. Mm-hmm. People don't realize that Democrats and Republicans, we vote together 70%+ of the time. Mm-hmm. We respect one another, and the relationships that are built up there really transcend even politics. And I think a lot of people get this idea in their head that the state level is like the national level, or what we see on TV is the national level, when it is actually quite the opposite. Topeka, Republicans, Democrats, we work together, we live together, we eat dinner most of the time together. I mean, we're really together for 4 months out of the year. And we support one another, you know, in session and out of session, because of the relationships that are built there. So something I definitely wanted to make sure I had a chance to share.
Yeah. So, you know that we have the state correctional facility here in Hutchison.
I was actually just there about 2 or 3 weeks ago.
Uh-huh. And over the years, I've had limited chances of being inside, did the mentoring program, being in relationship with folks. And also did other discussions. So the elementary school that's closest to the larger unit, that elementary school in Hutchison serves about 200 students. And at one point, and these numbers would be 10 years old, but I think it's fairly consistent. At one point, more than half the students had a loved one who was at one point in the correctional facility, either locally or in the state institution. And so that elementary school, the students there had lots of traumatic issues in their household. And so that elementary school looks very much different than another elementary school in Hutchison, although our community is having more and more issues across the board. So that was one of the interesting things. for me is learning. And we sent our granddaughter to that elementary school. And so I mentored with students there. I was in the classrooms a lot and just interacting with students. And so that was really a profound experience for me to walk with students who were had loved ones in the correctional facility and how that impacted their lives. So
how did you help a middle schooler or an elementary schooler understand that, you know, I can imagine as a young kid like that, trying to understand that my dad's locked away would be really hard. So tell me how did you help them make sense of that?
Well, so it's not one person, it's multiple teams. And one of the really good things that our community did was, you know, for students, if they see police as the adversary, if they're the ones that removed their dad. So especially if they visually saw that, their father being removed from the home. So one of the good things is having community police officers in the building developing relationships with folks. That's a really, and that's gone up and down in effectiveness in terms of budget and other things in our community. But that's one of the things I think is really good. But the study that I've done on how to help families and individuals with trauma is if the home life is stable and if they have enough access to enough resources and if they have lots of caring adults in their lives, then their lives can be transformed. And so my goal was just trying to communicate to the student that you are a person of value, that we care for you. I'm sitting here reading with you, but more just wanting you to know that you matter to me and you matter to the folks in the school. And so that's part of the reason why I'm here, is just trying to communicate that. So we were focusing on education, sure, and that really matters. But for the student to know that they matter in other people's lives. And so one of the studies that was really helpful for me is if students have three folks that they can identify outside of their home that care for them, they're more likely to succeed. And so that 3 to 5 folks is a really significant number in trying to be on that list for some students. So
that's awesome. But what a great service. I mean, it seems like our schools now are asked to play so much more of a support and a parenting role in many of our communities, whether they have a parent at home or not. It just, that's the feel that I get. I think Heston is a little bit, you know, well, it's its own unique, small atmosphere dichotomy. Our socioeconomic makeup is different than Hutchinson's and is different than Newton. But I hear that from a lot of teachers, that they're expected to take on so much more of a role in these kids' lives to care about them, because they're just not getting that at home.
What led you to be interested in the field of work that you did?
Well, I'll tell you, I have always wanted to work for myself. It's been a part of what I want to do since I can remember. And I started doing it when I was young, when I was 13, because I came from a family of 11 kids, right? Money wasn't plentiful. And when I was 13, I actually put an ad in the paper, 6-foot-tall, 230-pound, willing to work, call me. And I had a gentleman named Cy Ferrier, Sylvester Ferrier, gave me a call. And Cy took me under his wing as a wonderful farmer, taught me more about life and money management and entrepreneurship and just really how to live. Such a remarkable role model to me. But I've always been willing to figure out how to go out and make my own way. And when I graduated from college, I had an accounting degree and a business degree, went to work for a CPA firm. And that was fantastic. It was very exciting. But I also had a friend of mine that had introduced me to another field in the bonding world where, you know, we ensured that defendants appeared in court. And it was very interesting to me because I knew absolutely nothing about our criminal justice system. I didn't understand how it works or why it works or what role they play. But then I had the ability to be introduced to that And I saw opportunity. I saw a way where we could apply customer service in an industry that hasn't had it. We can apply resources and support to people and recognize what they're going through. We could approach things from a non-judgmental standpoint, because I am a firm believer that it's not for me to judge. But we can also play an integral role in the criminal justice system, and we can do it in a way that is very different. And so that's led us to have a good company over many years. We have about 40 to 50 agents statewide. And then that's allowed me to be involved in so many other things in different boards and different groups and nonprofits and things like that. And then get involved in a number of other businesses as well. So real estate is a big part of that for me. Also involved, I've got a couple of companies actually out in Utah that I have, that I'm a real big believer in people. People have so much value. If you can find where that value is, and surround them with the support that they can use, then I can help them become successful. And I love to be able to provide those opportunities, because now kind of my model has grown into, I haven't been actually in the bonding realm for about 10 years. I have great folks that actually run that company for me now, but I have had the opportunity to find very talented people and build companies around them and provide the support and the knowledge and the mentorship to allow them to grow and to find a measure of success for their family as well. So something I very, very much enjoy doing.
So when you talk about support, what would be concrete examples of support?
You know, ensuring everything. We have done everything from making sure that people have food in their house to connecting them with services that they need, to helping them find a bed in a rehab facility, to connecting them with resources in the mental health realm, buying them medicine when they need it. I mean, just a tremendous amount of things. And then, you know, on some levels, it just ensuring that we help them understand their responsibility and understand that, you know, they need to be at court, and that decisions made ultimately don't define what the rest of your life has to become. And really put a lot of emphasis on helping understand the root cause of what has led people where they are, and trying to help people work through those things.
Yeah. So Maslow's hierarchy of need, we use that in my, that's the layman language we use a lot in my work. So okay. The bottom is people being safe. That would be my translation of that. Making sure that your home life, your environment is safe, and then having access to resources, and then building connections, and then having sharing in your gifts, sharing, being self-confident, self-actualized is higher up on that. So that's what some of the things when I heard, that's why I asked the support question to sure. see that. And I noticed that would have fit in some of the first things you were talking about, and then you built on to that based on that hierarchy of needs.
Yeah.
Did I hear that correctly?
No, I totally agree with that. People have got to be safe. Again, for me, it all comes back to kind of that family unit, having that safe place to be. I served on the board of Heart to Heart Child Advocacy Center for about 12 years. And only stepped down because they're a state-funded agency, and I didn't want a conflict of interest. But I got to see firsthand some of the struggles that these kids have and the households that they come from. And then I take that context and I apply it to the state agency, which is, you know, DCF, mm-hmm. and the role that they play, mm-hmm. and what terrible, terrible parents the state of Kansas makes. I mean, we just make terrible parents. And so I remember about 2 years ago, I had a chance to vote on what was called the Family First Act, which focused on bringing resources, both state and federal resources, into the home and trying to work with these families before it came to people getting involved in the criminal justice system or DCF getting involved in happening to take their kids, because the statistics, as you well know, are terrible once a kid gets involved in the state system and is taken out of their home. So what we have to do, unfortunately, I say have to, is in a lot of ways, we've got to provide the support and the structure and help parents learn how to be parents. You know, I really believe that. And that's hard. I mean, I'm a real big believer that anything is possible through hard work and through preparation. We just need the right people to help us along the way. You know, I believe that God wants us to be self-sufficient, and he wants us to be successful, and he wants us to be good parents, because those are his children. Those are our children. And so I try to look at things from that perspective of how more can I make a positive impact on that as a state legislator, because I know statistically the best place for a kid is at home, as long as they can get what they need there and be safe. So yeah, a lot of it does come back to that safety aspect.
Yeah, and so that's been a big work of mine. So I don't know if you're, I forget what it's called in Newton now, but it was called Circles. Yeah, so I helped lead that and start that in Hutchison.
Awesome.
And so Jessica, for folks, part of a Circles work was working with families on helping them who were low resource to help them build resources, and so they could move towards self-sufficiency and to their future goals. So that's part of our work. So in that light, I have lots of opinions on what is community work, what is government work, what is in the blending of those.
Sure. Yeah.
So after your work there, where would you see that? What is the role of communities? And so that would be businesses, churches, individuals, school systems. Well, schools would be kind of in between, right?
Right.
Government agency and the community. So what are their roles to building up families?
Oh man,
making a good opportunity for kids and adults.
Well, I'll be honest, and it probably isn't a politically popular statement, but I really believe that the churches have a significant role in that, mm-hmm. and that the government should support that on some level. That at a minimum, they should be supportive of it, because religion and morality and ethics and the goodness that comes from that is one of the best guides that there are. Many people that go to church are the ones that are willing to serve, they're willing to help, they're willing to support, and they're also willing to give of their time and their resources to people. And anything that I think that the state can do to support activities that help bolster the family and help bolster parenting, I think is generally, assuming that there's a program and assuming that there's data, right? We shouldn't just be handing out government money for any program, but I think that there are plenty of great programs out there that have a theological basis that can bring so much value into people's homes and so much support and so much structure. So I think that absolutely is part of it. I realize some people like to say that you got to have a separation of church and state. A lot of people misunderstand that, in my opinion, because that was really the government not forcing religion on per a state organized religion, but religion and God permeates every part of the creation of this country, and religious freedom is at the core of that. And so I think there's a big role for them to play there. And I've always believed that. Same thing with our nonprofits, huge role for them to play. That the government, that's not what we're good at.
Yeah. So I would be a person who grew up in a conservative home, conservative mm-hmm. religiously and politically, and became discouraged by the lack of community involvement from churches and congregations and religious institutions. And that's actually what drove me to become more progressive, is my discouragement of church. Also, a huge influence would be living in Philadelphia and Philadelphia's history of the United States and religion and William Penn and Franklin wrote Ben Franklin and others permeates that city today. I don't think we all totally understand that, but that's where I went to seminary, and so that was pretty profound. So from my perspective, I'm pretty discouraged by the lack of helpful involvement from religious institutions, which leads to more need for nonprofits. But then, as a former person who helped manage a nonprofit, discouraged by that world too. So I'm a discouraged guy, Stephen. But I have this deep, profound hope.
Right.
So realism, what I realistically see around me discourages me, but deep within me, I have this hope of what could be.
But hopefully you're doing your part within your church to change that, then, I would presume. I mean.
Yeah, but it's really tiring. So I was known as the poverty pastor in our community for a long time. When we moved here 20 years ago, I saw that there was a bubbling catastrophe heading for our community. Coming from Philadelphia, I could see it coming and bubbling in our community. When I first moved here 15 to 20 years ago, our community in Hutchinson was naive to say, there was lots of religious folks who said, we don't have a poverty problem in our community. And I saw it, and I saw it bubbling. And, you know, we could debate the merits of free and reduced lunch, but, you know, in Hutchinson, we're well over 70% or right around that 70% range. Wow. for all the schools. And again, we could debate whether that's a good marker. I don't necessarily think that it's a good marker, but it is a significant number of folks who are struggling economically here in our community. And so now everybody sees it as a problem. Mm-hmm. It's, the debate is what to do with it. Yeah, so I just kind of throw that out there.
No, that's good. So tell me, so you mentioned the word progressive.
Yeah.
Define that for me.
So I'm going to answer it arrogantly.
Okay.
So there's an element in the definition of conservative that is protective. We have something and we want to maintain and protect it, preserve it, conserve it, be good stewards of this thing that we have. How I would use progressive is that there's an element that we're moving towards something. We haven't arrived, but we're moving towards it. So from my theological perspective, the reason why I would label myself more progressive is that, so I see everything I see, I run it through my pastoral lens,
sure.
My theological lens first. So that's the beginning point, and then I try to make it more consumable for other folks. But I see us moving towards something, not just hanging on to something, but moving towards something theologically. And so the question is, what are we moving towards? And so when I look at the community of Hutchinson, I see the realism of what we're at, but I think that there's something more and better and inclusive and beneficial for everyone that we could move towards. And that's how I would use, that's how I kind of see myself. My work is to help bring leadership to move towards something that everyone would feel welcome. So, and valued in our community. So, the language of progress is what I would write myself.
Interesting. So I just want to follow up on that only because I want to understand. Progressive has always been an interesting term, and I've never heard it kind of defined as kind of moving towards something. Like, in essence, you want something different than what was. But then the conflict that I'm trying to understand there with that is, well, let me ask you this. Do you believe that we are more or less religious now than we were 50 years ago or 100 years ago? And to follow that up, do you think there is more or less poverty as a result of that, or is that merely coincidental?
So that's, yeah. So there would be more religious attendance 50 years ago. The poverty one is really interesting. The numbers are relatively the same in terms of federal understanding of poverty. And partially it's because that number moves. But 50 years ago, the federal poverty rate was based on housing and food. And I would say housing and food, and because those were the two drivers, the most important thing. So the housing supply in the United States was not very adequate in some places. So that's why they built projects. They build Section 8 housing and different things like that. That was late 60s, early 70s, a way to address that. And food stamps came from that period. So housing and food were the drivers. And I think that for better or for worse, this country did a fairly good job with that. But those, I don't see that those being the drivers now of low resources now. So for example, when I was pastoring, my health insurance was higher than my mortgage. So I was paying more per month. And now my health insurance was different because it was through the church denomination. It was making sure small denomination, we were making sure that every pastor was covered. Lots of pastors had significant health issues. So we were doing, it was more of a communal thing, where we were making sure everybody was taken care of. That was the driver of the reason why my health insurance was higher. But it all depends on what we define as poverty. What is poverty now? And I think I'm making an assumption here, Stephen, but I think mental health and drug and alcohol and addictions would be more of a driver of poverty these days than it would have been 50 years ago.
Yeah, I would agree.
I also, so clearly there's less church attendance, less religious attendance than there was 50 years ago right now. But I don't think it's a lack of spirituality. I think there is, especially in central Kansas, people have attended churches and found them, or religious institutions, and found them wanting. So the question is, why do they find them wanting? I think that there's a huge hunger for spirituality and religiosity, but not how it's framed.
Not the traditional church.
Yeah, I guess I would go there. Okay.
I mean, I'm a traditionalist. There's no doubt about that. From that perspective, and so when I see some of these bigger, what I call mega churches or primarily online churches, I was just wondering if that's kind of what you're talking about from a framing perspective. So it's interesting that you share that, because again, perspective is so important in all of this, right? It's like in my bio, I read, you know, I believe we're the summation of our life experiences. And that's what leads me to not judge somebody that is a progressive or a liberal or a Democrat or whatever, because really it's our life experiences that have led us there. You know, I was raised by a conservative family, and I remember the days of Ronald Reagan, and, you know, so much of, the belief in the American dream that if we're willing to put out the effort, then there's opportunity all around us. And I think that my perception is that there has been less emphasis on teaching people to fish and more emphasis on giving people fish over the last 20 years. I think that if we as a state would focus on the resources that help people change their life and their circumstances, even if that means temporary assistance, but with the expectation that A, B, and C are going to happen, or you're going to work towards them. That's the type of thing that I love to see, because that is long-term significant change that can last generations, right? You break that poverty cycle, you can change generations. And I think that you go back to the days of the projects, for example, and the days of food stamps, there's no, at least my perception is, there's no expectation that you ever get off those. As long as you fall within this guideline, you'll always have that house, or you'll always have that assistance. But then we penalize them when they make $10 more than that threshold. So they don't want to make $10 more than that threshold. So that's a big part of my belief. I mean, and I've seen it firsthand in my life, where I'm a first generation college student, started with nothing. And it was a lot of preparation and a lot of just belief and hard work. And I believe that exists for all of us. We just need people to help us get them there.
Right. So I'm all on board on cliff effects. That's how we call it. So the actual driver. And so the numbers, when I was part of Circles that we did in the state of Kansas, now this would be 5 to 7 year old data, but the take-home income, and I'm just going off the top of my head, Stephen, so my numbers might be off, but the take-home income from about $10 an hour to $25 an hour was about $1,000 a month difference. Does that make sense, what I'm saying?
Sure, yep.
So the benefits that you, the extra support you got when you had $10 an hour, and the lack of those benefits, when you add those up, it was the same as almost having a $23, $24 an hour job.
Right.
Okay. So there was an incentive to grow economically, and move up in that system in Kansas, and it's across the country.
Right.
So I see that. The question is, how do we build that into our system? And my outside perspective is that I don't think the current economic system, and I would push, it goes back to Reagan years, does not encourage this, does not encourage that. I think we have a system in place that is built more on retirement and Wall Street benefits than it does for Main Street and in local communities. So I have to be careful because I work for a Fortune 500 company as a chaplain. And the business I work for hires me as a chaplain to care for the workers and to help make their lives better. And so it is a very unique business to say, yeah, we value our workers, but on the other hand, the first thing I see when I turn on my computer is the stock, where the stock price is.
Sure.
And what has happened in the last year with that. And so.
So I would love to figure out how we help people accomplish those same things. right? Yeah. I think in some ways, investing, and we could, that'd be a whole nother thing, is something that anybody can do at any level. They can now buy fractional shares of stock, right? They can do a lot of things. So that would be an interesting thing for us to dive down. But yeah, let's jump in. I know we're short on time. Yeah. So I'm going to go with that question because I think that's a great question. What gives you hope for the future?
Yeah. So conversations like this gives me hope, Stephen. So thank you very much for engaging this and knowing that we're connected through my family. My family is probably you are representing them in Topeka. So that's right. Exciting. I think if we have conversations, we can find common ground. And if we learn each other's stories, we can find common ground. So all the things that I think I heard you say about the self-empowerment, I think that that is deeply rooted in us. And I think people want that. They want to be equipped with the resources and the ability to live the life that they want to live. That gives me hope. That gives me hope. How about for you? What gives you hope?
You know, I see in the eyes of my grandchildren all of the opportunity that this country has, and the challenges that we face are not insurmountable challenges. Destiny would have us believe that the freedoms that we enjoy will end at some point. History would say that, but I would disagree. And I believe that it does come back to our ability to disagree agreeably and work towards solutions that, I mean, even as we've sat here and talked, we're you know, appears we're on different sides politically, but we are also on so many of the exact same sides when it comes to families, when it comes to religion, when it comes to so many things. We agreed that so many of the things that are affecting are things that we can work on. And we're on the same side of those. And so I have a lot of hope because I see it firsthand, and I see in Topeka people willing to reach across the aisle and their desire to make this state and this country a better place. And even though the media doesn't like those headlines, I'd always say that the headline that says legislators work together again in Topeka will never make clicks on TV or on the internet or never sell newspapers, but that's what happened. So I have a lot of hope because I've been able to see that, contrary to popular belief, a lot of people are willing to sit down and work together. And if we foster that, I think we're going to continue to steer ourselves in a good direction.
You know, Stephen, it's really interesting. One of the things I came from circles is that we can't control our first thoughts. My first thoughts typically are from a conservative perspective from my childhood.
Okay.
And then I argue with them. Then I argue with him, but I constantly have those first thoughts, and then I have to make a choice. Well, what am I going to do with this first thought? So, so I label myself as a progressive, but my first thoughts are conservative.
well, in that, knowing what I know about you now after this last hour, that makes a lot of sense, understanding that. But I think that, you know, based on what I'm hearing, your idea of progressiveness is simply bettering the world for the people that aren't as blessed as you and I are. And that is something that we can absolutely agree on, because that's exactly what I want. I relish the opportunity to talk to people about building businesses and working through business plans and striking out on your own and you know, money management. We take young families under our wings regularly and talk to them about what's a will and what's a mutual fund and just all of these things that we take for granted, but we all have the desire to help lift other people up. And that is hope in and of itself, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Is there anything else either of you would like to share?
No, just I can tell you how much I've really enjoyed getting to know Jim and understand his perspective. And I knew this was going to be a fascinating opportunity, but it never ceases to amaze me how much similarity we all have in our lives. that and how much we can truly agree to when we just sit down and we talk about it.
Now, I agree with that. Absolutely. We came from very similar silos.
Yeah, we did. That's right. Yeah.
Both Bethel College and then MDMIP in Central Kansas, not far from each other. So I wanted to highlight that, but I do agree with you. I think my wife, yeah, I do agree with you. So
awesome.
Thank you.
Absolutely. So. Thank you.
Well, if you have conversations with our representative, Jason, Jason's a friend of mine. And so,
Jason Probst.
Yeah. So he would be a Democrat and he would, and I don't know how many conversations with you, but I think his starting point and our starting point is very similar too.
He does. It's going to be interesting. I know he's got a tough, election coming up. But I've spoken with Jason many times, very passionate about what he believes. And I respect the heck out of people, even if I don't agree with some of their decisions, but their passion, right? He is truly trying to do what he believes is best for his community. And I respect the heck out of that.
Yeah.
It's great. So-